This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It was another whirlwind week of news, but let's focus first on the fixer who flipped. Sometimes prosecutors will promise reduced punishment in exchange for a defendant giving information and testimony against someone else, usually against a bigger target. President Trump says he knows, quote, all about flipping, after his former personal attorney Michael Cohen agreed to a plea deal that implicated the president in a campaign finance violation. Mr. Trump has spent the last few days trying to distance himself from Cohen, but not before badmouthing him in a tweet. We'll start there, but there is so much more to discuss as we look back on some of the week's biggest stories and head to how next week will take shape in the headlines. Joining us for this Friday News Roundup is Priscilla Alvarez, an assistant editor with The Atlantic. Priscilla, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Nicholas Johnston, editor-in-chief of the news site Axios. Nick, welcome.
Thank you.
And we had him on at the start of the week to talk about Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Now he's back to sort out some more. He's like a bad penny. He just keeps showing up here. Shane Harris, an intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post and a Future of War fellow at New America. Shane, glad to have you with us.
Happy to close the loop. Thanks, Josh.
We're also glad to. I don't know if this loop can close, really. We're going to do our best, though, to answer some of your questions and comments. Let's start with Michael Cohen. His plea deal pushed its way to front page news on Tuesday and basically stayed the top headline in one form or another ever since. Mr. Cohen's deal with prosecutors started with an admission of guilt to a number of financial crimes. One of them implicated the president in a federal crime involving campaign finance violations. Now, this story seems to grow and metastasize every hour, but let's catch up with what we know. And we'll start with you, Shane. Take us back to just the guilty plea on Tuesday. What exactly did Michael Cohen cop to?
Right. Well, specifically as it relates to this issue that it now implicates the president, he is pleading guilty to campaign finance law violations, specifically with regards to the payments that were made to two women who alleged that they had affairs with Donald Trump before he became president. And this was money that was either paid in one case to silence one woman, and money that was paid in another case with the connection of a media company to essentially buy her story and then never publish it, what's called as a capture and kill. Effectuating those payments essentially constituted, according to the guilty plea, a campaign finance violation. These were money payments that were in excess of what is allowed under campaign finance law, one in one case from Michael Cohen, the other from this corporation, American Media Incorporated. Now, that in and of itself is, you know, it's a serious criminal violation of campaign finance law. It's not a civil violation in this case. But what really made this extraordinary is that during his court appearance in New York, Michael Cohen said, I made these payments, arranged for these payments, knew they were illegal, and I did it with the coordination and at the direction of a candidate for federal office. He didn't name Donald Trump. It is clearly Donald Trump who he's talking about. So he is saying in court, I committed crimes, knowingly committed crimes, and I was told to do so by Donald Trump.
He also noted that he did it, quote, for the principal purpose of influencing the election, unquote. Priscilla Alvarez, but does this mean, if we just kind of try to hit this nail on the head, does this mean that President Trump violated campaign finance laws? I mean, I think it's still, from a legal prosecutorial standpoint, despite what Michael Cohen said, that's not quite enough to go after the president by itself, right?
No, but if you think about a typical scenario in which you have a lawyer that tells prosecutors that his client directed him to commit a crime, in that case, we would probably see the candidate in this case would also be indicted. But we are dealing here with the president of the United States. And so typically there is no direction or explicit mention in the Constitution that a president can't be indicted, but it tends to not happen. The Justice Department does not or has not indicted sitting presidents. So this is an incredibly strange scenario to an extent because of who we're dealing with and who Cohen is pointing to.
Nicholas Johnston, in the hours after Cohen's plea deal, the president didn't have much to say about Cohen. The next day, he started tweeting about Cohen and Cohen's character, basically kind of called him a rat, a snitch, essentially.
Right.
He also did an interview on Fox and Friends where he continued to badmouth Cohen. Give us a sense of what some of the president's reaction to this has been.
I mean, my favorite part of the reaction was the tweet he had where it was just like, Michael Cohen's a bad lawyer, don't hire him. Like, that's excellent legal advice since he's probably going to prison. now. The president sort of, the evolution of this relationship is fascinating, because remember at the start, Cohen was very famously said he'd take a bullet for the president. And then he's had this, I guess, evolution. Sort of Lanny Davis, his attorney, explains this a lot on television about how he's sort of seen the light and he realized that the president is bad for the country. And after the Helsinki press conference with Russian President Putin, Cohen is like, oh, no, actually, this is a bad president and I've been doing horrible things for him. And now I'm going to sort of turn state's evidence and sort of try and expose all of these horrible things that he's done. And that's what the president went after again, this horrible, what he calls this horrible practice of flipping, which is, I think, the fundamental way federal prosecutors take down what they call criminal enterprises. You look for that central target, and you start sort of drawing circles around them, starting at the outer edges and getting people. And this is what Robert Mueller has done, step by step, finding them, getting some detail on them, something they did wrong, convincing them that you've got that detail, flipping them so they then give evidence to the next person. And so now we've gotten, the rings have gotten closer and closer and closer, and the last person he flipped implicated the president.
I'm not an attorney, and I'm not asking any of you to speak as one unless you have a law degree I don't know about, but it sounds like the president kind of was suggesting that prosecutors shouldn't be able to get criminal defendants to cooperate with federal investigations, that there's a larger, I don't know if he knew that he meant it like that, but to me, that's kind of what that comment means. Like, oh, prosecutors shouldn't have defendants give them information to get other bad guys. Like, what?
Right. It's fair to say, as Nick points out, I mean, this is a bedrock tool that criminal prosecutors use to secure convictions. And it is another extraordinary moment to see the chief law enforcement officer of the United States say that they should be deprived of that because he doesn't like the fact that it's being used potentially against him. And he also called on Attorney General Sessions to get involved. Again, he is continuing to harangue him this morning on Twitter for not shutting down the probe, for not doing something to stop this. I mean, we have seen these kinds of interventions by the president for months now. And I guess in that sense, it's not surprising that it's happening when the investigation is getting so close to him. He's also in this fascinating interview with Fox and Friends he did this week. He's trying to somehow contort the facts of what happened by saying there couldn't have been a campaign finance violation because the money that was paid to these women, which he acknowledges happened, didn't come out of campaign funds. That's not what the law is about. It's not about whether he used campaign funds to pay them off. It's the fact that other people paid them off, and that is a thing of value to the campaign. So it wasn't entirely clear to me if the president doesn't understand what the actual statutory violation is, or is trying to sort of twist the narrative into something that it's not for the purposes of making this all seem like a witch hunt.
The best angle on that and some of the legal reasoning I've read is that if the president had just made the payments and put them in his FEC filings, that's totally fine.
Right.
It's always the cover-up. It's never the crime.
Regarding that payment, Kent in Oklahoma writes, since Trump says he paid the $130,000 and not the campaign, did he then deduct the money on his taxes as a business expense? If he says no, then he should be asked to prove it by releasing his tax return. Matt tweets, a plea deal does not necessarily mean Cohen has flipped. That would require a cooperation agreement. I think Matt's right. He's got a plea agreement, not necessarily a full cooperation agreement for immunity and so forth, at least not that we know of. Cecil writes on Facebook, I'm not in any way a Trump supporter, but if there was ample evidence, the special prosecutor would have made indictments. Now, in that same interview on Fox and Friends, President Trump took aim at the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. Here's part of what the president said.
As I've said, I wanted to stay uninvolved. But when everybody sees what's going on in the Justice Department, I always put justice now with quotes. It's a very, very sad day. Jeff Sessions recused himself, which he shouldn't have done, or he should have told me. Even my enemies say that Jeff Sessions should have told you that he was going to recuse himself, and then you wouldn't have put him in. He took the job, and then he said, I'm going to recuse myself. I said, what kind of a man is this? And by the way, he was on the campaign. You know, the only reason I gave him the job, because I felt loyalty. He was an original supporter. Mm-hmm. He was on the campaign. He knows there was no collusion.
Part of President Trump's interview with Fox and Friends that aired yesterday. Priscilla, so many ways that he kind of threw the attorney general under the bus in this interview. I only got the job because he was loyal to me. I can't believe that he wouldn't tell me about this, and putting justice in quotation marks. Why is Jeff Sessions getting dragged into all this?
This has been an ongoing feud between Trump and Sessions over some time now. over immigration, over particularly this investigation. He continues to be very bitter about the fact that Sessions did recuse himself from this investigation, putting it on the deputy attorney general. There are a few things that he mentions there, and it has come up with Manafort, it comes up with Cohen, and that's loyalty. He feels that he doesn't have that loyalty from Sessions, and that irks him. And it's worth remembering that Sessions was one of the first Trump supporters when he was senator. So this is just part of the ongoing feud. I think what was most extraordinary about this particular comment from Trump is that it did get a response from Sessions. It's not the first time that he's been criticized by Trump, but this time he did release a statement in which he said that he took control of the Justice Department when he came in, and it was a pretty hard response back to the president. So that was a development that we haven't seen yet, and we'll kind of see how it plays out going forward.
Nick, before we move on from Michael Cohen to Paul Manafort, Jeff Sessions did respond to the criticisms against him. Give us a sense of what his response was and what the president's response to the response was.
Yeah, Sessions came out and said he has taken control of the Justice Department, that he's in charge, that he's the attorney general. What's fascinating about this, as we wrote this morning, is it sort of shows how the president views the Justice Department. That's so in such a different way. He views it as his Justice Department, as like his lawyers, his legal team, like just same as he would view Michael Cohen. And so he's flummoxed that they're not doing his wishes, that they're not serving at sort of his behest. It's sort of like the way Donald Trump views sort of like legal overall, like sort of the legal system overall, sort of how to use that, how it should work for his benefit, that those are his lawyers. And he wants Jeff Sessions to be his lawyer, while Jeff Sessions is not being his lawyer. He's being America's lawyer as the attorney general at the Justice Department. And I think that is that tension. And now the latest bits we're seeing is folks on the Hill who had been defending Sessions are now starting to give signals that maybe he'll be replaced after the midterms.
Yeah, some of you have commented on this as well. Biz writes, is the president mad that Sessions took the job and knew he would recuse himself even before he took the job? Or is he mad that Sessions recused himself at all? Catherine adds, how could Sessions have known ahead of time that he would recuse himself from an investigation that only heated up after his confirmation, where he perjured himself? Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire writes, did Donald Trump really think in the glare of the presidential spotlight he so craves that he could keep all of this under wraps? Is he so arrogant or complacent as to believe no one would talk? Why do the good, honest, moral Republicans, that I still hope are the vast majority of the party, not put their tribal identity aside and fix their party while there's still time? Speaking of keeping things under wraps, there's one more aspect to the Michael Cohen story we should get to before we keep going. It involves a guy named David Pecker, who is the chairman of American Media Incorporated. That's the parent company of the National Enquirer. Mr. Pecker has reportedly been granted immunity by federal prosecutors for his role as a key witness in an investigation into the Trump campaign. Shane Harris, these reports have kind of moved very quickly in the last 24 hours, but the mainstream of it seems to be, A, that he's cooperating, and B, that there is this cache of unflattering, perhaps humiliating stories about Donald Trump that has been literally kept under lock and key for like 10 years that someone knew to rehide before the inauguration. How much of this have we sussed out so far?
Oh, I think we're still plumbing the depths of this, and this is going to be a very rich area to look at. So if we go back to what we were talking about, the campaign finance violations of the coordination of those payments to women, one of those involved American Media. So that's the one of the two counts that involves an illegal corporate donation. So American Media has this practice, it's been unearthed largely by a lot of great reporting in the Wall Street Journal and some other places too, about capturing and killing stories. And they have kind of, what we're learning now, become a repository for all kinds of embarrassing information about Trump over the years. I think it was the AP last night that reported that there's literally a safe in American media offices where some of these stories are kept, as you said, under lock and key. The fact that David Pecker has been granted immunity and is cooperating, it's not quite as oh wow of a moment as Michael Cohen, but it's like right behind it. I mean, this is somebody who was very much a Trump loyalist. You could argue that he was a Trump publicist in the way that the National Enquirer, which AMI owns, had run story after flattering story about Trump during the campaign and unbelievably negative stories about Hillary Clinton, many of which I think are probably based on fabricated and false information. So to see this now coming that David Pecker is cooperating is yet another single signal that this investigation is very tightly closing around the president.
And Priscilla, I would imagine that if this safe exists, if you know, if that is true, that we're not just talking about, you know, stories. I mean, how many news organizations do you know that store their stories as like a stack of paper anymore, but documents and other materials that might constitute something akin to blackmail, that this might be a cache of other things besides just finished reporting from the Enquirer?
Well, yeah, because the idea was to catch the story and to grab all this information and kill it and make it disappear. So there is, I mean, we expect there to be a lot here, and that's something that we'll kind of see develop.
I should say that a number of you have been asking some really great questions about Michael Cohen. We should, however, move on and talk a bit about Paul Manafort. The former Trump campaign chairman was found guilty on 8 out of 18 counts of tax and bank fraud this week. The judge declared a mistrial on the other 10 counts, and prosecutors have until Wednesday to decide if they want a retrial. Now, some of the behind-the-scenes drama is coming to light. Paula Duncan, who was a juror, told Fox News that the jury almost convicted Manafort on all 18 counts, but were held back by one juror.
We all tried to convince her to look at the paper trail. We laid it out in front of her again and again, and she still said that she had a reasonable doubt. And that's the way the jury worked. We didn't want it to be hung, so we tried for an extended period of time to convince her. But in the end, she held out, and that's why we have 10 counts that did not get a verdict.
That was Paula Duncan, a juror during Paul Manafort's trial, speaking to Fox News. Nick Johnston, I wonder if we have any sense of what this might mean going forward, what prosecutors decide to do next with Paul Manafort, especially because he's got another trial coming up.
Right, right. That's an interesting question. I don't have any reporting on that. Shane might know better than me if there's any sense of what the prosecutors might do yet. But they got him on 8 counts, which will have a considerable jail time for that. There is another trial coming. I mean, like, Paul Manafort is almost certainly going to prison for a very long time. Like, they busted him. So I don't think, like, it's almost on the sidelines here, like, whether we're going to go back and get those 10 counts or because there's so much more coming and there's so much more that's sort of already achieved on that. And what I found fascinating in the juror interview since we had one up is that there was one who, it may have been that same one who spoke to Fox, who was an avowed Trump supporter, who wanted Paul Manafort to be innocent and then was swayed by the volume of the evidence and eventually came around and said, yeah, no, he's guilty.
Shane Harris, can you give us a sense, by the way, of what exactly Paul Manafort was convicted of?
Yeah, these are felony counts of tax evasion and bank fraud. And it's important to note that of the 18 counts, the ones that sort of sit in different buckets, he was convicted of charges in all of those buckets. So even though they couldn't get reach a verdict on those last 10, this shouldn't be read as somehow they only got half a loaf. This is a very successful prosecution, legal experts are saying. In terms of those remaining 10 counts, they could go back and prosecute him again. He was not acquitted of those counts. There was just not a verdict reached. Now, that will take up considerable resources of the same prosecution team that also has to now go start this trial in September in the District of Columbia related to the work that he did for the government of Ukraine that he didn't register for. So you're going to get more into there to the actual kind of work he was doing. I would suspect that a question now for Paul Manafort is, are you ready to cooperate? It was very strange to those of us, I think, who were observing the first case that knowing that the government's evidence was going to be so overwhelming that he wasn't prepared to flip, that he wasn't prepared to cooperate. We wondered if that meant that he was holding out for a pardon from President Trump. President Trump has been sending signals in the past couple of days that that might be something he's considering. We've seen reporting that he was thinking about it at some point recently. So now this is a question for Manafort. Is he ready now, facing yet another trial and potentially state charges down the road, to try and get a better deal for himself and minimize the sentence, which will almost certainly be more than a decade? He could spend the rest of his life in prison.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder where Manafort fits into the rest of all this, of whatever happens next. Emily emailed, Manafort ended up guilty but did not throw Trump under the bus. Cohen threw Trump under the bus. Trump praised Manafort. Makes it sound like Manafort probably still knows information that will make Trump look bad. Priscilla, that's an interesting idea, particularly considering President Trump's tweets after the verdict. He wrote, among other things, quote, "I feel very badly for Paul Manafort and his wonderful family. Justice," and the word justice is in quotes, "justice took a 12-year-old tax case, among other things, applied tremendous pressure on him, and unlike Michael Cohen, he refused to break, make up stories in order to get a deal. Such respect for a brave man," unquote. Priscilla, what does this look like is going to be the next step from here?
So there are two common threads in that tweet. Number one, that he's seeking loyalty. We've seen that a lot this week with Cohen, with Sessions, and with Manafort. But the other part of this is the way that he's framed it to be unfair to Paul Manafort. And that's why there is speculation that there could be a pardon. We are not sure. We know he reportedly asked about it and was advised against it. But the language he used, unfair, particular, that's the same language that he used. And it fits a pattern with Joe Arpaio, who he also pardoned, Scooter Libby. So he is signaling here that he is sympathizing for Manafort. So he seems to be dangling a pardon. Again, we do not know if it's going to happen. And that could play into Paul Manafort and how he considers his next steps. So does that mean cooperating and, you know, flipping on Trump? Does it mean that he holds out in hopes that a pardon does come through? So that is what we're going to be watching out for when it comes to Paul Manafort.
Yeah. Shane, just put one more point on this. When Trump says it was a 12-year-old tax case, among other things, the among other things that he is charged with is working for a puppet government in Ukraine of the Kremlin. Paul Manafort took a job as the campaign chairman of the Trump campaign for no money, and there is compelling evidence from his own communications that he was prepared to provide information about that campaign to other people connected to the Kremlin. So there is a nexus here with the sort of the C-word story of collusion, right? I mean, and Paul Manafort may in fact have very pertinent information to what the special counsel is looking at.
Tom W. writes, I don't think Mueller's team happened upon Manafort and Cohen while running the Russia collusion investigation. I think agents were directed to turn Manafort's and Cohen's lives inside out to find anything they might charge them with. Before we move on, Nick, there's a problem with that assumption, isn't there? I mean, Mueller found the information that led to those prosecutions while doing the Russia investigation and handed it off. I think Tom might be off base, but what do you think?
I wouldn't view it as a direction to go and find Manafort and get Cohen. What is really important to read about the special counsel's mandate is to investigate Russian interference in the presidential election and other things. Like, remember the Whitewater investigation that led to President Clinton's impeachment? That started on a land deal, and it picked up. Whenever you find kind of wrongdoing, you are allowed to follow those paths. And in Robert Mueller's investigation, when he sees something that Manafort was doing, when he was seeing something that Cohen was doing, even if unrelated to that very specific first part on Russian collusion, they are perfectly empowered as federal prosecutors to follow that.
Let's move on to another story that's been making headlines this week. Authorities in Iowa positively identified the body of Molly Tibbetts, 20-year-old young woman, this week. Ms. Tibbetts was a college student who went missing more than a month ago. The discovery of her body was aided by a 24-year-old Mexican man who is now charged with murdering her. Cristian Rivera is undocumented. He's said to have been in the U.S. since at least 2014. Despite some of the attempts of Tibbetts' family members to stop it, the tragedy of what happened to her is beginning to become part of the hot political debate about U.S. border policy. Before we get into that debate, Priscilla, let's first talk about this case. Give us a sense of how Rivera and Tibbetts came to be linked and how this all kind of came together.
Yeah, so this investigation has been underway for some time now, and they found her body, and they, you know, through many, many interviews, I think at one point they said they had over 1,500 interviews, they came to Rivera, and he, if I remember correctly, had led them to the body and sort of handed himself over. So where there started to be a lot of confusion to some degree, and where it pulled in the immigration debate, was that there was a detainer request for him, and so that would lead many to conclude that he was undocumented. That was still a little unclear because you don't have to be undocumented to have one of those requests, and there was speculation that from his own attorney that he came in through E-Verify to work on a farm in Iowa. So now we are led to believe that he is, in fact, undocumented. His attorney has not provided any sort of evidence to say that he came in through E-Verify, and USCIS has recently said that they do not have any record of him lawfully being here. So that pulled in the whole immigration debate, and Trump sort of hinged on it during a rally and talking about how it's a danger.
He also commented on this in a video he posted the day after Rivera's arrest was announced.
Molly Tibbetts, an incredible young woman, is now permanently separated from her family. A person came in from Mexico illegally and killed her. We need the wall. We need our immigration laws changed. We need our border laws changed. We need Republicans to do it because the Democrats aren't going to do it.
Part of a video the president posted on Wednesday reacting to this case. We should note that law enforcement says that Rivera is undocumented. His attorney has said that he is here lawfully. Some comments from you about this case. Tom wrote on our Facebook page, 1A, still avoiding the news about an illegal alien, again, murdering a citizen. There are hundreds of cases just like this and worse every year as Democrats and NPR try to protect illegals from prosecution and deportation. Nick Johnston, I feel like there's a fair amount to unpack from this. First of all, we didn't avoid the story, but that's become part of the perception that the press would just rather talk about the president than this. There's also this idea of there being hundreds of cases and the Justice Department kind of shifting focus to the victims of crimes by undocumented immigrants. And then there's the political piece about Democrats and the way that our current immigration system works.
Let's start with the political piece. I've covered immigration for a long time, and this was an incendiary topic even back in the Bush administration. For specifically these kinds of reasons, crime committed by people in the country illegally is a very emotional topic, and it's something that opponents of immigration, sort of supporters of border security, would very much sort of like very draw attention to. I remember there was a lot of instances of immigrants in the country illegally involved in drunk driving accidents. That was a huge emotional issue, which if people in favor of border security would very much focus on. And we had Axios talked to Newt Gingrich earlier this week specifically about this issue, and he painted the picture sort of in the midterms. Like, if Molly Tibbetts is a front page story across the country, you know, Republicans win House races because that is an issue that definitely motivates their base, definitely motivates the people who support President Trump and the desire to build a wall. The flip side, as Gingrich told us, you know, if it's Cohen Manafort on the front pages, well, then Democrats have a win. So this is a very emotional topic, as immigration has been for essentially this country's entire life. And it's a very politicized, I think, topic on both sides.
It also kind of reminds me of the case of Kate Steinle, that young woman who was shot on the pier in San Francisco by an undocumented immigrant. He was acquitted of the murder charge, but convicted on a lesser gun charge. Shane, I wonder what impact this has on the ability to actually do something about immigration. I mean, there's a difference between heat and light. And to an extent, this story feels like it's gotten very hot. But I don't know how much this has illuminated for us what is actually going on in our immigration system, what Congress could do to fix it. I mean, I don't know if this helps or hurts.
I don't think it really helps. And look, we are just a few months away from the midterm elections. Congress is not going to move any significant legislation, certainly not immigration reform, which they tried to tackle already, and that failed. So, I mean, politically, look, I think Speaker Gingrich kind of lays it out pretty nakedly, right, is that that is the calculus, that if they can keep talking about this, that is ultimately good for them. And Donald Trump goes back to the wall as kind of a touchstone of something that animates the base. They will also, though, have to contend with Democrats, I'm sure, in the midterm races, running pictures of children screaming and crying as they're separated from their parents at the border. There is a lot to unpack in this immigration debate. This isn't the first time, obviously, as Nick's saying, that politicians have seized on a personal tragedy and tried to take the microcosm to point up the bigger problem. But I don't have any sense that this really moves the needle or gets both sides closer to coming to some agreement on immigration reform.
Some of your comments about this story. Christine tweeted, "No, the debate over the tragic murder about Molly Tibbetts is not about illegal immigration. It is about men perpetrating violence against women every day." Magan agrees. Magan writes, "Molly Tibbetts was murdered because she told a man to leave her alone. A white dude just murdered his pregnant wife and two children, so I don't know what a wall is going to do to keep y'all safe." David Wicks emails, "I think it resonates with a lot of voters when Trump speaks out about crimes by illegal immigrants, especially when many on the left are so staunch in their support of illegal immigrants that they will even defend MS-13 as humans when Trump calls them animals. Priscilla, talk about the rhetoric of all of this, particularly after the talk of, say, defunding ICE or getting rid of ICE. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congressional candidate in New York, kind of put that up at the top of the news for a while. Some Democratic leaders like Nancy Pelosi have said, so that's not necessarily the best idea, but the rhetoric seems to be getting in the way of doing anything.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we saw this back in the 2016 election. There was a lot of inflammatory rhetoric around immigration, and the Republican, or at least the Trump campaign, realized that it works. It motivates voters. It has for a long time, as Nick noticed. But the thing here is that Democrats have also seized on this, and the farther left has said, you know, let's abolish ICE. This came around the time when there was family separation as well, which was also very emotional and also complicated because it included several agencies. And so there is a lot of back and forth, but I think it comes down to what Shane was saying, is that it's hard. It doesn't really help. It doesn't really push any sort of effort on the Hill at this point with the midterm so close. And there have been attempts to, for years now, to reform the immigration system, and there always lacks a consensus. So this, we're going to continue to hear this heated rhetoric, I'm sure, from both, as the midterms, you know, near, but on the Hill, we're not going to see any action for now, likely.
Let's talk policy this week, particularly environmental policy. Andrew Wheeler, who's the acting administrator of the EPA, signed a plan on Monday that would roll back regulations on coal-fired power plants. The new plan would all but erase the Clean Power Plan from the Obama administration. Nick, can you tell us a little bit more about this? As I understand it, one of the most significant changes would give states the authority to decide how much to cut emissions within their state borders.
Right. I mean, no one should be surprised by this. The president ran as a defender of coal country, clean, beautiful coal, as he likes to call it. And this is just another piece of sort of the step-by-step rollback of all of the Obama administration. Like when the President Obama did a lot of things administratively, that means the next president can undo them administratively. And there's been a very long time of sort of rolling back regulations, almost more than industry even wanted. We've done some stories about how industry kind of liked at least the certainty of having a sense of what the regulations are going, particularly automakers on some of the fuel efficiency standards. But President Trump has been full speed ahead on this, and then unrolling the Clean Power plan was just the most recent one.
Now, a number of states, Shane, had sued the Obama administration after these old rules, but some states had already begun to implement the changes. So what happens now?
Well, that's right. So you have this sort of disconnect where, I mean, even in California, they're pursuing their own environmental policies separate from the federal level. And you might see more of that kind of action, and that could really have some real impact. I mean, California for generations actually has had environmental rules that are often stricter than the national standards as well.
Like auto emission rules.
Exactly. There's something else also that's interesting in this rewrite, the pullback of the rules. I was talking with an energy expert about this, and that embedded within this is something of a rewrite to something called what's known as new source review, which is an EPA program that means that anytime an energy plant is going to be built or renovated, you have to calculate the number of pollutants that are going to come out of it, not just carbon dioxide, which is what we're talking about here with the Clean Coal Initiative or this other Obama-era plan, but other kinds of pollutants as well. That's being gutted as well in this pullback. So you're really talking about not just necessarily even this specific issue related to coal, but something that could have even broader ramifications. And as Nick points out, this is very much an aspect of the president keeping a promise that he made on the campaign trail. But it's not at all clear that it's going to revive the coal industry. And coal plants are shutting down not because of regulation. They're shutting down because of market forces, because natural gas is cheaper, more abundant, cleaner, and energy
easier
companies,
to extract.
Yeah, and energy companies have built their entire business models around this, so to the point of some companies even saying, we don't need these regulations. A lot of companies in the energy industry have moved on from this and are already planning for a future that didn't include coal. So you're not going to suddenly reignite an entire industry that was that would have been thriving but for regulation.
Yeah, and the administration's own analysis of its own plan said that the new rules could lead to as many as 1,400 premature deaths, 1,400 premature deaths annually by the year 2030 because of rising pollution linked to heart and lung diseases. Dean emailed, "The proposed changes to regulations are crazy. Air, like water, doesn't stay in a state. They both flow to other states and thus must be federally regulated. Otherwise, a state could build a bunch of coal-fired power plants on their eastern border and let the downstream states deal with the consequences." Let's get back to politics for a moment. Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort were not the only political figures who ran into legal trouble this week. Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter of California and his wife were both indicted for campaign finance violations and wire fraud. The 47-page indictment has over 60 counts, and it details exorbitant spending, thousands of dollars on video games, almost $400 on a zip line, a $14,000 family trip to Italy, and almost $500 at a bachelor party for 30 tequila shots and a steak. Now, this list goes on. And Priscilla, I personally, as a PlayStation fan, I would not have indicted him for the video games, but that's just me. But setting that aside, what is the significance of all this? Is it the exorbitant spending or is it something else?
Well, so there's a few things here, right? So we have the misuse of campaign funds here, but we have, this is the second Republican congressman to receive an indictment in the last month. Chris Collins was the other, and he allegedly leaked confidential information about the failure of a drug trial to his son, which saved them hundreds of thousands of dollars. So for the GOP, this is a problem, especially during a midterm election year. But also, for Hunter in particular, it's nearly impossible to get him off the ballot. So even though he is facing all of these charges, unless he asks a judge to remove his name, the GOP really has no power to remove him. So there are two things that are at play here and that are certainly a burden to the party versus a help moving forward.
How likely is it, though, Nick, that Duncan Hunter will still win re-election? I mean, what impact do we see this potentially having on the midterms?
I have not seen a poll on that yet, because no one would ever thought to poll Duncan Hunter's race. This was a layup for Republicans. I think, getting back to the corruption point of Chris Collins and now Duncan Hunter, Democrats had been starting to hammer Republicans as a party of corruption. And now they've got the two first congressional supporters of President Trump have been indicted. And like I was saying before the show, there's nothing like reading a really good indictment. And the Duncan Hunter, just a really good indictment. Just all the details that prosecutors have of text messages and emails of how they were trying to hide these kinds of charges. How are they trying to explain it away to the treasurer? How the treasurer quit and they had to get a new treasurer because of all these kinds of things. So I think certainly, like, you know what? Just this morning, I started to see stories pop up about who is Duncan Hunter's Democratic challenger. Until Duncan Hunter was indicted, who cares? Now we've got a race on our hands, which is just one more seat that is now in play that Republicans might lose, added to all the others, and is why I think Democrats have a reasonably good shot at winning the House.
Matt wrote on our website, the1a.org, anyone see the news that Duncan Hunter is saying his wife handled all the finances? Talk about getting thrown under the bus.
Yeah, he is now saying, well, I didn't do anything wrong. In 2003, when Duncan Hunter was a Marine and went off to fight in Iraq, he said, I handed over power of attorney to my wife. And so any financial shenanigans, I guess he's saying, are his wife's fault, which is probably not going to go over well at home, much less with a jury.
No.
You know, at a particular point, too, we mentioned his military service. I covered Congressman Hunter's work on the Armed Services Committee for a number of years. There are specific charges here that he tried to hide personal purchases by making them seem like they were done for the charitable purpose of veterans. That is not going to sit well with the constituents in his district. It is not going to sit well in light of his service as somebody who has been an advocate for service members and for veterans issues.
And just to be clear, I'm sorry, but in terms of where his district is, his district includes parts of San Diego County,
right,
where there's major, you know, military presence.
Oh, yeah.
Riverside County,
major
once
military,
you get out,
you're talking Navy SEAL country down,
right,
there.
You get out toward, yeah, 29 Palms, yep, and the bases in San Diego. Like, it's a large military constituency.
There's a text in the indictment where he disparages the Navy.
Right.
It's while
really,
on vacation,
yeah,
in Italy.
Yeah, and this is somebody who really did make his bones in Congress about being a military advocate and going after corruption in the military. It was something that Duncan Hunter was known as for reporters who were looking for great stories about people in powerful positions in the military abusing their positions of trust. He had lots of stories to tell about that.
A few more stories we'd like to get to before we have to move on. Since 1913, a statue known as Silent Sam stood on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But on Monday, this happened. And tear it down they did. That was the sound of student protesters toppling Silent Sam and breaking into cheers when it fell. Priscilla, this is another case of a controversial Confederate statue being brought down. I wonder kind of how did this develop and how UNC handled it?
Yeah, so this has been something that we've seen as part of the national conversation for some time now. You know, I think it actually had gone quiet for a little bit, and then we had this monument come down. And it sort of, again, sort of brings up the debate that we've seen time and again when these monuments come down of whether this is a reflection of history and reflecting back, or whether they should have never been erected in the first place. So that debate is sort of, you know, opening up again. But in the meantime, you know, the monument is down, and I don't believe at this point there are any plans to bring it back.
Should note that we are keeping an eye on the weather in Hawaii, where pouring rain, flash floods, and landslides have hit as Hurricane Lane gets closer. The storm has weakened to a Category 3 status from a Category 5, but Category 3 is still considered a major hurricane. Its winds fueled a brush fire on Maui that's forced nearby residents to evacuate. The eye of Hurricane Lane is expected to pass either over or near Hawaii tonight. Before we go, one last story. The best selling album of all time for a very long time has been Thriller by Michael Jackson. That album moonwalked to the top of the charts after he passed in 2009. But this week, the King of Pop was dethroned by a beloved classic rock band.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now.
The Eagles' Greatest Hits compilation took the top slot as the best-selling album of all time. It's been on top before. The same album had been number one before Michael Jackson died. Some of you are a bit incredulous about this. Mac writes, "Greatest Hits albums don't count. Long live Thriller." Joel pointed out the record was broken only in the USA, not the world record, and he tweeted out a link to the Guinness World Records article about Thriller being number one around the world. Larry emailed, "Maybe it's because I'm a millennial, maybe it's because I'm black, maybe it's because I'm a black millennial, but who in the blue hell are the Eagles?" I know some of you have real issues with this before we go. What's wrong with the Eagles being number one?
This may be the most surprising news of the week. And I was taken by
more than Michael Cohen.
Look, I love Hotel California as much as the next guy, but I was really surprised. Where are all these Eagles fans coming from?
I know.
I mean, I've lived my entire life with the idea that Thriller was in this indomitable position at the top of the charts, and I'm blown away by this.
I think this is a national travesty. I'll just leave it at that. And, you know, come at me
this
on Twitter,
rigged.
Everybody.
Billboard is rigged.
Yeah, Nicholas is at Axios Nick in case you want to come at him. He's also the editor-in-chief of Axios. Nick, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Priscilla Alvarez wisely stayed out of that debate. She's the assistant editor with the Atlantic. Exactly. Thanks, Priscilla. And Shane Harris, who reports on intelligence and national security for The Washington Post. Thanks, Shane.
Thanks, Joshua.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're talking with one of the coolest cats around, Lenny Kravitz.
I remember this kid walked up to us in the hallway and he goes, "Your dad's white." And he pointed his finger like that.
Subscribe now.
Russian trolls seem to be going after much more than our elections. Their next target? Spreading disinformation about vaccines. Also this week, Big Tech says Iran is getting into the cyber disinformation game. You can guess who and what they might be going after. President Trump spreads false information about what is happening to white farmers in South Africa. And not for the first time, Australian politics is a bit of a mess. Joining us this week for the Friday News Roundup is Roslyn Jordan, state and specials correspondent for Al Jazeera. Roslyn, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much.
Uri Friedman, staff writer at The Atlantic covering U.S. foreign policy. Welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
And Indira Lakshmanan, columnist for the Boston Globe, and starting this Monday, the executive editor at the Pulitzer Center. Congratulations, Indira, and welcome.
Thank you so much, Joshua.
Usually we start with the news from a country. This week, we're going to start off with a theme that's been coming up in a number of stories this week, and that theme is disinformation, not misinformation, like, oops, that wasn't quite the right data. Disinformation, intentional bad information. On Tuesday, Facebook said it took down 652 pages, groups, and accounts that it said came from disinformation campaigns originating in Iran. Among others, the campaigns targeted the Middle East, Latin America, and the U.S. Later that same day, Twitter suspended nearly 300 accounts. Twitter said it was also coordinated manipulation, allegedly from Iran. Facebook CEO and co-founder Mark Zuckerberg was eager to be seen as proactive on this. He told reporters, quote, "While it's still early, we're starting to see it pay off and we're identifying more of this before the election," unquote. That quote according to CNN. Also this week, there was a study published in the American Journal of Public Health. The study said that Russian troll accounts that attempted to influence the U.S. election had also been posting about vaccines. One of the researchers involved said that content about vaccines was used as a wedge issue, but the science has overwhelmingly concluded that it is best to vaccinate your child. Indira, let me start with you. What do these moves mean? Is it a sign that social media is stepping up its game? Is it a sign that the disinformers are stepping up their game? A little bit of both?
Both things are true. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, this is, we have seen not only since 2016, 2016 is when we became aware of it at a very large scale, that disinformation from Russia, you know, the internet research army, you know, all these different factors, all these different factions who were out there planting disinformation for our 2016 campaign, they have been at it ever since. They tried to influence the French elections. They tried to influence the German elections. They're going to try to influence our midterm elections. And so this is about that. But the spreading of the disinformation, I mean, in a way, planting this information about anti-vaxxers to try to support anti-vaxxers, I mean, I would say that some of it is also trying to seed belief among those who they feel are vulnerable to believing disinformation. So you take the group of anti-vaxxers. Science has proven definitively, I mean, this is one of those things like climate change. This is proven by the science. So if you don't believe in vaccines, I'm sorry, but you know, science is science. It's real people. And so those same people who are vulnerable to that kind of disinformation would also be vulnerable to disinformation about politics. And I think that's what we were seeing in the Russian campaign. And of course, Facebook and Twitter and others have to be so aware of this because they were blamed for so much of what happened, the manipulation of our election, that now they're having to up their game.
Yeah, and Rosalind, they are indeed upping their game, or certainly trying to do so very, very forthrightly. It's so fascinating that, like, the battlefield of the future is in the minds of Americans. It's just fascinating.
It's brewing a lot of cultural dissension. It's brewing disunity. It's really breeding mistrust among people who otherwise would agree, oh, we love our children. Oh, we love our communities. We love having clean air and clean water and everyone getting along with each other. When you do this sort of thing, I've seen it in my own social groups. People stop talking to each other. People stop socializing with each other, which means people don't work together on community-wide issues because that fundamental mistrust has been laid. And one other thing that I find fascinating is that it doesn't cost a lot of money to do this.
Yeah.
There's one estimate that it may have taken the Iranians maybe $12,000 at most to set up these websites and to start pumping out this misinformation. Very cheap. That's sort of the downside of easily available technology. It doesn't take a lot, but the ramifications are so widespread, it could take a generation to really unwind all of this.
And we should note, Uri, I'm sorry, is it Uri or Uri?
Uri.
Uri. I got it right the first time. We should note, Uri, that the U.S. is not the only place where this is happening. I mean, we've seen this in, you know, Germany's recent election. We've seen this kind of disinformation in France leading up to the election of Emmanuel Macron. Like, this is happening parallel to the far right rise in Europe. What sense do we have of whether governments around the world are dealing with this proactively, or are they all kind of leaving it to Facebook, Twitter, Google, Microsoft to save us?
I think governments are dealing with it proactively. I mean, one of the things that was most striking about this latest revelation is that it showed that Iran was doing this not just in the United States, but in the United Kingdom, in the Middle East, and Latin America. So this is pretty far flung. I would say the people who I've seen who have done it most proactively are a lot of Western European governments. During the French election, there was a real effort to get ahead of any kind of disinformation campaigns. And in the UK right now, there's a big debate about the degree to which disinformation affected the Brexit vote. And I think they're really paying attention to that ahead of future polls. So I think, and the other thing that I've seen as governments being proactive about is that they are starting to realize that this is not just a problem from Russia. I mean, as we saw, this is also a problem from Iran. And more than that, China, which is a very big cyber player, is probably watching very closely. So I think they're being proactive. The thing that I would say, though, is that no one has fully figured out the solution because everyone is so plugged into social media and so vulnerable to being misled on social media. And also because, as Rosalind mentioned, these things come cheap. So, you know, if you can, for $100,000 or $10,000, reach millions of followers, how do you combat that, you know, in a way that is effective? And I don't think any government has totally figured that out. I would say the French government in real time, in a real specific case, their election was probably the gold standard for how governments are doing it so far.
It feels like a real difference, Indira, in the way that Europe is dealing just with Silicon Valley in general and the way that the U.S. deals with Silicon Valley in general. Whether it has to do with the right to be forgotten online, or monopolies, or taxation. This feels like one of those areas where international law becomes very important when we're talking about fighting disinformation, especially because I believe it's Facebook, Twitter, and Google that have a hearing next month here in Washington. Do I have that right? Is it Facebook,
that's right.
Facebook, Twitter, Google that right. have a hearing, and you might have different kinds of online environments in the U.S. than you have in Europe.
Absolutely.
All facing the exact same kind of problem.
Right. I mean, look, it's no secret that Europe is a far more regulated environment than the United States. And so that is why we all started getting all these notices on every account we have about cookies and this and that, because all of these internet companies are and platforms are having to comply now with European laws that you're talking about, not only right to be forgotten, but not to be tracked, not to have cookies, all of these things. And what Silicon Valley is trying for is they don't want the United States to put the same kind of regulations on them, because they can still say they're U.S.-based companies. Although, by the way, many of them have offices in Ireland that allow them
right.
to escape taxation and claim that they're, you know, companies, Irish companies, but that's another matter. You're absolutely right. It's a far more heavily regulated environment in Europe. But I want to say, to the point we were making about disinformation, it's, of course, not just disinformation. Some of it is the really cheap get out there bots, fake accounts, you know, spreading all sorts of disinformation, but some of it is also cyber attacks. And for that, John Bolton gave an interview to ABC's Martha Raddatz in which he talked about, we're also looking at North Korea, we're looking at China, we're looking at Iran. And let's not forget that in 2011, Iran did a bunch of cyber attacks which affected more than 40 American banks. So, you know, cyber attacks and disinformation have become more and more linked here. And so I think the government, I know the Senate Intelligence Committee is having a hearing on this. They're going to be talking about the links between disinformation and cyber attacks.
And very briefly, it's not just the websites. I think pretty much anyone who's listening to this program who has a cell phone or a smartphone has received some sort of phishing phone call from a phone number that looks similar to their phone number or resembles a phone number that they might know. And this is also being considered a way of trying to access people's personal information, more specifically what's stored on their cell phones, which is why the CFPB is telling people don't answer those numbers. Don't even hit, you know, I can't talk right now, because that sends a signal that this is a valid number.
That you exist.
That you exist, and that there might be a way to then try to access your information on that phone. It's really insidious.
James writes, why is it disinformation rather than propaganda? Disinformation feels sterile in a way that the general public can more easily dismiss these events. Uri, I know we got to pause in a minute, but I think that's kind of the point, is that disinformation is easier to just kind of accept in the flow of all the info you see on Facebook, and that's how it gets in.
Yeah, I think it's designed in a way to be valid for people, and propaganda people can often dismiss more easily. You know, if it's something about how the Iranian government is the greatest government in the world, or that it's abiding exactly by the nuclear deal, you know, that might be more dismissed than something that actually looks kind of like what you're seeing in your daily stream of information. I think that's why they're focused more on disinformation. And even spreading internet memes that originate among Americans. This is not something that they are cooking up themselves. They are just promoting conversations already happening online.
On Wednesday, yet another tweet from President Trump plumbed new depths of international diplomacy. This latest one was in response to a segment on Tucker Carlson Tonight, a primetime show on Fox News. It was a segment about the South African government, specifically the move by those now in power to give back land that was stolen from black Africans during apartheid. Now, the controversial policy has been latched onto by white supremacists around the world as evidence of what they refer to as white genocide. Here's the tweet from President Trump. Quote, I have asked Secretary of State at Sec Pompeo, Mike Pompeo, to closely study the South Africa land and farm seizures and expropriations and the large-scale killing of farmers, And then he quotes Tucker Carlson in the tweet, quote, South African government is now seizing land from white farmers, at Tucker Carlson, at Fox News, unquote. South Africa's government tweeted back, quote, South Africa totally rejects this narrow perception which only seeks to divide our nation and reminds us of our colonial past, unquote. Uri, let's step back from the dueling tweets. What's the backstory with the South African farmland? What actually happened?
Yeah, so during apartheid, a lot of land was taken away from blacks in South Africa. There has been an effort, really, this goes back more than two decades. Since 1994, it has been in the Constitution that land redistribution should be a part of this. And there's a good reason why. Wealth inequality is huge in South Africa. Black South Africans make up about 9% of the population. I'm sorry, about 79% of the population and own less than 9% of land. And that is inextricably linked to wealth inequality. And
so 4 out of 5 South Africans are black, but fewer than 1 in 10 landowners is black.
That's right, direct landowners. And as a result of that, there has been an effort since 1994 to, when there are willing buyers and willing sellers, to redistribute land. The difference right now that is based in factual, has a factual basis, is that the new president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has said, we want to change the Constitution to allow some expropriation without compensating those whose land is being redistributed. That is still not a law. It is just a proposal. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. And the biggest – there are two really important things to fact check here. One is that there have not been large-scale expropriations yet. And then secondly, there has not been any kind of large-scale targeting of white farmers. Actually, when you look at South African statistics, the number of killings on farms has been on a decline since the late 1990s, early 2000s. And so this has become a meme as an example among white nationalists of, targeting whites, but there is not actually a factual basis to the way that it was reported on Fox News and conveyed by President Trump on Twitter.
And Indira, I'm also wondering about this large-scale killing that the president referred to.
Is that happening? No, absolutely not true. I mean, first of all, what the president is doing here is he's signaling to white nationalists. This is a dog whistle because this did not begin with Tucker Carlson and Fox News. This began deep in the hyper-partisan white nationalist alt-right, media sphere. This is a conspiracy theory. It's false. It's made up. The actual figures, which were posted by Associated Press yesterday from the South African police, were that killings on farms were 140 in the year 2001 to 2002, and they were down to 74 in 2016. To 2017. So they've halved since 2002. So in fact, they're going down, not going up. Let's face it, South Africa is an extremely violent country with very high murder rates and high violent crime rates. But the vast majority of the victims of those crimes are actually black South Africans. So white South Africans who live on farms or in affluent suburbs are murdered at far lower rates than people in poor, predominantly black townships. So that's one thing. There is absolutely no campaign of race-based killings that's going on. And so, this is really much more, I would say, about domestic politics signaling than it is about anything else. And Uri is right that the current ANC government has been advocating this amendment to the Constitution that would allow the expropriation of land without compensation, which follows 2 years ago, Parliament passed a bill that allowed expropriation with compensation. But even so, there's still this very unequal distribution of land. The reason the ANC is doing this, the ruling party, is because it's facing a challenge from the left flank and from a left-wing party that wants to put in a law saying that only blacks should be able to own land. Mm-hmm. And so ANC is trying to respond to that. So it's somewhat domestic politics as well. It doesn't mean they'd act on it because, let's face it, when Zimbabwe did something similar in the year 2000, their economy completely collapsed. It cost them $20 billion. The white population in Zimbabwe, it caused, as I said, an economic collapse. So it was a terrible idea. And I would be very surprised if South Africa were actually going to follow, given that they have right next door an example of what happens if you do something like forced expropriation.
And we know how deep the economic hole is in Zimbabwe that they're still trying to dig out of. But Roslyn, I kind of wonder, just stepping back even further, just from a policy standpoint, the president's tweet says that he has asked Secretary Pompeo to study this. Has the U.S. ever had any official policy stance on land, on amends after apartheid, on expropriations? Are we involved at all?
The short answer is no. The question was put to Heather Nauert, the State Department spokesperson, on Thursday afternoon, and she said that, yes, the president had communicated this desire to take a close look at the situation, but Heather refused to be drawn into whether Secretary of State Mike Pompeo corrected the president's perception of what's happening in South Africa. She would not get into what she said is a privileged conversation between the president and one of his cabinet members. But there is this real sense that by sending out this tweet, the president created certainly a diplomatic problem. The chargé d'affaires was called into the South African Foreign Ministry for a little chat. She did confirm that meeting did take place. And certainly the administration now has to basically fix ties with a country with which it has very good relations in general. So it was another unforced error, as one might say.
Speaking of diplomacy, we would be remiss not to mention the passing last weekend of a legendary Ghanaian. Kofi Annan died at a hospital in Bern, Switzerland at the age of 80. He was the first black African to lead the UN. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001. Among other roles, he was the chief of UN peacekeeping before he became Secretary General in 1997. Here is a portion of his Nobel Prize acceptance speech.
Because beneath the surface of states and nations, ideas and language, lies the fate of individual human beings in need. Answering their needs will be the mission of the United Nations in the century to come. Thank you very much.
Part of Kofi Annan's acceptance speech after winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001. Now, the timing of his time at the UN means he oversaw some of humanity's worst moments, including the Rwandan and Bosnian genocides. He witnessed the beginning of the Iraq War, which deteriorated relations between the U.S. and the UN. Uri, what's your sense of Kofi Annan's legacy in the UN and in diplomacy more broadly?
I think he did have huge successes. The biggest one that I always think about is the Millennium Development Goals, which happened in 2000 and was a really ambitious effort to fight global poverty that actually was incredibly successful. But I also do think of he was one of the top official in peacekeeping during the Rwanda and Srebrenica massacre in the Balkans. And those were times when the UN really did not manage to stop a really terrible humanitarian catastrophe. I also think of him as someone who tried to manage the United States' role in the United Nations. In a way, the United States is the most important power in the United Nations. And he was there. You know, his biggest controversy was over the Iraq War, which he initially opposed, but then tried to help with post-war reconstruction. And I think he always knew that I have to somehow keep the United States on my side while also brokering with other big powers and stand up to them when I need to, but also manage to keep them in the loop. And that's something that I think his successor, Antonio Guterres, is trying to do right now and could learn a lot from Kofi Annan in the sense that he's dealing with an American president who's very skeptical of the organization.
Rosalind, you have been kind of keeping an eye on some of the remembrances of Kofi Annan and the way he's being thought of. What have you seen?
He had a mixed legacy, and he was the first to tell you that he had a mixed legacy. Obviously, Rwanda, he ignored the entreaties of General Romeo Dallaire to try to prevent the genocide in 1994. Just didn't move quickly enough. A million people died in a matter of a year.
The Rwandan genocide.
And he very publicly regretted not doing more to prevent that. He got into a very, very heated, almost personal animosity with George W. Bush over going to war in Iraq, over the failed, you know, some would say lie of WMD inside Iraq. And yet George W. Bush issued a very nice condolence message when he learned of his passing on Saturday. This is also someone who did not simply retire and go off to the countryside and, you know, sit in his pool all day. The man was the first person to try to broker an end to the civil war in Syria. granted, he threw in the towel after 4 months because he said Bashar al-Assad and the rebels have no desire for peace. They're much more interested in trying to kill each other. So he was very clear-eyed about what he could do and what he couldn't do, but he felt that if you didn't try, that it wasn't worth the effort. And I saw many people crying on Saturday. I mean, visibly upset and grieving over the loss of someone they considered a mentor in their form of public service.
Indira, do you get the sense that the kind of leaders that the diplomatic corps needs today are like the Kofi Annans? Are we looking for another Kofi Annan? Does the UN's current complexion kind of represent a shift away from that? Like, when we look at the future of diplomacy, what do we see?
Look, I mean, the problem with having the role of UN Secretary General, and Kofi Annan faced this, but so did everybody else who's come before him or after, is that you're essentially a secular pope. You are a person who's out there in the world trying to represent what is right, what is good, but you don't have an army to enforce that. You have peacekeepers. You don't ever have enough money to enforce your humanitarian goals. So you're like up there as a moral compass and conscience for the world, calling out this problem, calling out that problem, but you never have the monetary or military or other kinds of resources or all the countries on your side. So it's a tough role to be in. That said, I mean, I think he had also this very genteel character, this sort of kind of very aristocratic bearing. He sort of moved in all worlds. As we said, he was the first Black African to lead the UN. He was also the first Secretary General who ascended from the rank of civil servants, which is pretty significant. But I do think the stain of the years that he spent as the head of peacekeeping during the Rwandan genocide, during the Srebrenica massacre, during the death of American peacekeepers, by the way, in Somalia, that will be remembered. And also the fact that in 1998, let's not forget, he went to Baghdad to try to negotiate with Saddam Hussein over weapons of mass destruction and shook hands with him, smoked cigars with him. You know, that sort of followed him as a stain. And then years later in the 90s, it was discovered that his son was working for a Geneva company that was implicated in the oil for food scandal with Iraq. And so even though there was never any proof that Kofi Annan himself knew about that or facilitated that, he certainly didn't strongly investigate it. So that will be remembered too. But you're right. The role of secular pope is not an easy one. And whatever way someone wants to do it, there has to be more support given to the UN in general for them to be effective.
We will talk about the Catholic pope in Ireland in a little bit. Another Africa story we thought was worth mentioning, the tweet from President Trump that we mentioned earlier came on the heels of an announcement by First Lady Melania Trump that she is going to make her first overseas solo trip to a number of countries in Africa. We have yet to hear when she will go or what exactly the itinerary will be. Well, we talked about the Secretary General of the UN being something of a secular pope. The Catholic Pope is in Ireland for the World Meeting of Families and dealing with some of the controversies surrounding the Catholic Church in Ireland. We'll get to that in just a moment. Also, Australia has a new prime minister again. It's the sixth one in a decade. Why can't Australia seem to hang on to a head of state? Why did the last one go? What's the new one doing there? And how long is this guy going to last? Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Handmaid's Tale is intense, but if you think watching it's hard, try directing it.
I have to put myself into the scene and be all the characters.
Emmy nominee Kari Skogland, this week on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Uri Friedman, Indira Lakshmanan, and Rosalind Jordan. Let's move on to Europe now. The U.S. deported an accused Nazi to Germany this week. 95-year-old Yakov Pali was living in Queens, New York, when he was taken from his home in a wheelchair and flown to Dusseldorf Airport. The U.S. government accuses him of involvement in war crimes for his work as a guard at a concentration camp. Calls for his deportation have lasted more than a decade. The White House is celebrating his expulsion as a win for the administration, but Germany may be unlikely to prosecute him due to a lack of sufficient evidence. In Ireland, hundreds of thousands of people are preparing to hear from the Pope. The World Meeting of Families rally always has a big turnout. This year, the event will have a more somber tone in the wake of a damning report about more child sexual abuse and a decades-long cover-up by Catholic leaders in Pennsylvania. This week, Pope Francis released a letter calling for change to the culture in the Catholic Church and admitting that the Church failed young people. We discussed this at length earlier this week, and you'll find that conversation online at the1a.org. Indira, what do we expect to hear from the Pope, particularly being in a country like Ireland that's had an evolving relationship, shall we say, with the Catholic Church?
Right. I mean, I thought it was very interesting when I learned that this was the first trip by a Pope to Ireland in 40 years, considering that Ireland is 80% Catholic and has been, you know, a very devout country, not so in recent years. We see a move away from a sort of disillusionment with the Catholic Church, part of which was evidenced by this vote recently to overturn the ban on abortion. But it was one of the last countries in sort of, you know, between the Europe and the United States that had still a ban on abortion. That's now been overturned. So the Pope on Monday wrote this 2,000-word letter in which he expressed shame and contrition for all these abuses against thousands and thousands and thousands of children around the world, we now know, at the hands of deviant Catholic priests. But what people in Ireland are saying, both survivors, you know, people who are speaking out about this, is that it's fine to say you're sorry, but an apology is not enough. They want actual action. They want to see concrete steps that the Catholic Church is taking to make sure that this does not continue anymore and to make sure that people who are still alive, who are implicated in these kinds of abuses, are actually held accountable. And that's where this Pennsylvania grand jury report that came out is so disturbing, because it shows really a conscious cover-up over 70 years involving 301 priests and more than 1,000 children that we know of who were abused by them. That's that we know of. And we know of several other states that are involved in this now. Ireland has its own history of, I'm sure people have heard about these laundries where pregnant, unmarried Catholic women were sent and forced to work and their children were taken away from them. Those were for-profit institutions of the Catholic Church in Ireland. So there is a history there of cover up and, you know, not coming clean about these issues. The priest is going to the Pope is going to have a lot to deal with. And let's not forget, two U.S. cardinals, high profile cardinals, have already pulled out of this families conference in Dublin because they, you know, had to deal with the church abuse scandal back home.
And the Pope also has a credibility problem because of how he has responded to the abuse scandal in Chile. You know, there was the suggestion that he was ignoring the role that some of the leaders in the church in Chile were playing in covering up for the abuse by lower priests, and that he wasn't tough enough on them. So really, the bar is very high for Pope Francis in terms of how he's actually going to address which is now a global problem. It's not just something that happened in Boston in the 1990s or what we're seeing in Pennsylvania or what we're seeing in Ireland. This is on pretty much every continent where the Catholic Church has a visible presence. And he, if he wants to actually keep people in the flock, he's going to have to actually push through systemic change which the cardinals are very likely to resist.
And it's worth noting, Uri, also there's been a protest to the Pope's appearance that sprung up. There's a Facebook campaign called Say Nope to the Pope, which is encouraging people to get the free tickets for the event in Dublin and then not go, to basically leave the audience empty on purpose. But for many people, seeing the Pope in person is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We remember what traffic was like in and around Philadelphia, and the whole Delaware Valley kind of shut down when Pope Francis visited. I wonder where we see this going, Uri, whether this call for a boycott will succeed, whether the Vatican is making progress, restoring faith. Like, where does this go?
Yeah, I think it's really striking when the last pope visited Ireland in 1979, it was John Paul II. He had, I think it was over a million people came to his Sunday Mass. That's like a third of the population of Ireland. This time around, they're expecting like 500,000 and hundreds of protesters. So this is going to be a very different scene. I think there's a lot more questioning happening, not just in Ireland, but around the world of the pope. You know, I saw one Irish missionary who described this as, we're stumbling in darkness within darkness. And I don't think the pope has found the light yet, you know. He tried with this letter addressing all of the Catholic faithful and expressing contrition, and people felt that's not good enough. We want you to take responsibility. We want to see concrete ways that you are going to discipline priests and you are going to try to root this out, and you are going to admit that there was a systemic effort to cover this up. The Pope has not done that. For example, Rosalind mentioned Chile. In Chile, all the bishops in Chile to try to address the problem in Chile tendered their resignations. The Pope accepted about five of them, but they just resigned. There wasn't a disciplinary process like the one he had outlined in 2016. So there may be more of that, but I think I would look for less rhetoric from the Pope and more action for an actual change.
I would refer back also, before we keep going, to the program we did earlier this week about the culture of the Catholic Church. We had a young priest on from the Chicago area, from Joliet, and we asked him, if you suspected that abuse was going on in your diocese, what would you do? And he said, I would call the police and then I would tell my superiors. And I had him repeat it. I said, say that again. You would call the police first? And he said, yes, those are my instructions.
Let's be fair that the American Catholic Church has done more than the European Catholic Church, by the way. They have put in canonical law saying that you have to report these abuses in a way that the European Catholic Church has not put it in. And you've seen some Irish Catholics saying, if you can do this new canon in America, why can't you do it here as well?
In India, millions are keeping an eye on the weather there. We're keeping an eye on Hurricane Lane, of course, in Hawaii. But in India's southern state of Kerala, it's suffering its worst monsoon flooding in a century. Those floods have displaced a million people. Hundreds are reported dead. Meteorologists say deforestation is likely a major factor in the flooding. The floodwaters are starting to recede, but they need more aid for folks who are being looked after in about 4,000 temporary camps. Also, the northern coast of Venezuela experienced a magnitude 7.3 earthquake this week. Thankfully, there were no casualties reported. But Venezuela has a lot more than natural disasters to worry about. And after a magnitude 7 earthquake, that says a lot. This week, President Nicolas Maduro has taken steps to address the nation's incredible economic crisis. He's implemented new economic measures, including devaluing Venezuela's currency, the Bolivar, by about 90%, 90%. Rosalind, what all is going on in Venezuela in terms of addressing this crisis, and is any of it working?
No, it's not working. Hyperinflation is still rampant. Thousands of people are still headed for the borders, and they're running into problems trying to find a place of safe haven. Ecuador and Peru are now insisting that people show up with passports, which have been historically difficult to get anyway, before they are allowed to cross the border. So people are now crossing illegally. So you now have an incipient humanitarian crisis in not just Ecuador and Peru, but also in Brazil. Also in Brazil, some local residents have been attacking the Venezuelans who have crossed over because they're saying, well, we already don't have much here in the western part of the country, and now here you are coming in and taking in our resources. Maduro is still arguing that because of pressure from the United States, that's his favorite bogeyman, that the Venezuelan economy is not prospering, that it's very difficult to sell Venezuelan oil, and then he's also cracking down on political opponents. I mean, it's just a real mess in Caracas.
I want to make sure we have time to talk about Australia, but we should also note, with regards to what's happening in Venezuela, as Rosalind mentioned, there have been nearly 2.3 million Venezuelans that have left in the past 2 years because of what's going on. Indira, there's also a migration crisis coming out of Costa Rica via Nicaragua, because for more than 3 months, there have been protests continuing in Nicaragua that have caused this exodus.
That's absolutely right. I mean, just one last thought on Venezuela. What a tragedy this is. This is the country that has the largest proven oil reserves in the world. world. 10 years ago, I was based in Latin America, used to cover Venezuela regularly. Gas was cheaper than water. Now they're having to raise the prices on gas. They have 83% inflation. It could go to 1,000,000% by year's end. 4/5 of the population lives in poverty. It's a true crisis. And this paquetazo rojo that Maduro called it, the big red package, which he says is really impressive magic. That's a joke. I don't expect that to be a silver bullet. As far as Nicaragua goes, this is a really interesting full circle uprising here, in the sense that Daniel Ortega, who's been president for 22 of the last 39 years, is now facing an uprising among students in particular from León in Nicaragua, which was really the cradle of Sandismo, you know, of the Sandinista movement. And now those people are rising up against him and his wife, saying that they have undue power. It's a really interesting kind of full circle story. The same people who, you know, he was up against Somoza, who had too much power, and now people are looking at him and saying, you have too much power. And something like 300 people are estimated dead in these protests and the police violent crackdown on them in the last few months.
Let's talk about Australia. It has a new prime minister named Scott Morrison. But for how long will it have him as prime minister? Now, Australia seems to be treating its prime ministers like disposable razors. I mean, he's the sixth one in just over a decade. The former PM, Malcolm Turnbull, was forced out by rivals in his party. He had been under pressure from poor poll results and what he described as an insurgency by conservative MPs. Uri, I wonder what's going on. By the way, I should note that our executive producer is British, and I have been corrected that Australia's head of state is not the prime minister. The head of government is the prime minister. The head of state is the queen. So my apologies to the queen. But, Uri, what is going on in Australia? Why can't they keep a prime minister?
Yeah, it is amazing to see this. And there's actually a lot of poetic justice here. Malcolm Turnbull came to power in 2015 in an intra-party feud in which he ousted Tony Abbott, the former prime minister, and now he has been ousted as well. I think there's been a lot of reflection in Australia. It's been interesting on the political system and what is causing this, because it has intensified over the last decade. And part of it is kind of these parties within themselves are having a lot of identity crises. You know, here we saw conservatives pit against moderates in their liberal party. But beyond that, you know, an election happens every 3 years in Australia. And so part of the problem is you're constantly in campaign mode. It's hard to think any more than short-term political gain because you know an election's coming up. And in fact, we have an election coming up in Australia in May, and it might even come sooner because Turnbull may leave office as a lawmaker, and therefore there might be a special election. His party might lose a majority. So as a result, there might be an election earlier than before. And so I think, you know, people are in Australia, especially voters who feel very disillusioned by politics, who feel that everyone's just feuding with themselves and out for personal ambition and not paying attention to really serious issues like energy prices and a drought that's happening right now.
Climate change is a factor in this, isn't it?
Huge, huge. And that's been controversial. One of the issues that kind of, happened to Turnbull and caused his party to turn against him was over energy prices. So they had committed in the Paris Agreement to cut emissions. And then there was a feud within the government about whether they should actually cut emissions. And interestingly enough, in part because Donald Trump had pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And so some in the party said, if Donald Trump pulls out, why should we be cutting emissions?
One more story I wanted to get to before we run out of time. Vegetarianism is a growing global trend. It's been shown in some studies to have great health effects for people and for the environment. Eating less meat tends to lower your risk for heart disease. It lowers the amount of greenhouse gases released into the atmosphere. Health and the environment were two reasons the army in Finland announced this week that the soldiers will be served 2 vegetarian meals per week. But Finland's defense minister ain't having it. In response to the announcement, Jussi Niinistö told a Finnish newspaper, quote, "This forced feeding seems to be an ideological decision. As the old saying goes, an army marches on its stomach. No army can fight on lentil soup or cauliflower shakes," unquote. I'm with the defense minister.
There is better vegetarian food than those
shakes.
Don't
even try to convince. Look, if I had to go vegetarian for a week, there would be no show. Indira would have to drag me out of the chair and take over.
You know, there are some really good edamame and quinoa burgers out there that I have had. I would be happy to bring some
edamame
in.
Edamame is a side dish.
We've had this conversation about your aggressive meatitarianism before.
Yes. Meatitarians of the world, unite. No cauliflower shakes in this studio. Thank you
that
very much.
That does sound gross.
Indira, Indira Lakshmanan, columnist for the Boston Globe and executive editor of the Pulitzer Center as of this Monday. Indira, thanks for talking
thanks
to us.
Thanks so much.
Ori Friedman, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks, Ori.
Thanks for having me on.
And Roslyn Jordan, state and specials correspondent for Al Jazeera. Thanks, Roslyn.
My pleasure.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. I'll be on the panel this Sunday on Meet the Press. Hope you tune in, and I hope you enjoy the weekend. As always, thanks for listening. This is 1A.